Milo's Pro Rewards members. Save big during Lowe's Pro Savings Days. Get your member volume discount plus an extra 5% off eligible orders with a quote of $2,000 or more. And buy more and save more with up to 20% off in-stock molding when you spend $250 or more. Members get more at Lowe's. Valid through 7/31. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Can't be combined with any contract or special pricing. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit the Pro Desk or Lowe's.com/terms for more details. Subject to change.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car look in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome to segment number two of our continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates on the case as we bring them to you. Let's head back to the courtroom.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
When we left off, we were talking about the $192,000 that you had put in your trust account to cover the defendant, correct?
Yes, sir.
And he had signed his promissory note up on the screen, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Before I move on real quick, I want to show you what's been previously admitted into evidence of States 313 and see if you recognize that.
I do, yes, sir.
And what is that?
Looks like the original of the $225,000 check payable to Richard Alexander Murdaugh Esquire from my trust account dated March 10th, 2021 on this case.
All right, and that's your signature on there, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Catch the jury back up. He had asked you to send that email. You sent the email in July, and then you had those conversations in August that ultimately led to that promissory note, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then nothing more going on with it. Does anything happen in early September related to this?
Yes, sir.
And what day was it?
Friday, September the 3rd.
Tell me what happened.
About 3 o'clock in that afternoon, I'm with a group of guys. I get a phone call from Lee Cope.
All right.
I tell Lee that I can't really talk much because I'm in the middle of a crowd. He says Alex's stealing money, that we found out Alex's stealing money from the firm and from clients, and he's going to resign from the firm. And he wanted to know if I had the $792,000 in my trust account. I told him I did. He said, well, we're going to need to get that paid to us, and asked me not to say anything to anybody about any of it until the following Tuesday when they could issue a press release.
When you told him you had that $792,000 in your trust account, did that still include $192,000 that you had covered?
It did.
Okay. What happened next?
I talked to Lee very briefly again. He told me he was in the middle of trying to deal with all that they were dealing with, and he couldn't talk. That first phone call from him was like very brief, and then I think we talked again after I got away from the crowd. But he told me that he couldn't talk long, that they were in the middle of trying to deal with all that they were dealing with, and that we would talk later. And, I had to kind of go back to the crowd that I was with and try to act as much as I could like normal so that, I think they realized that I'd stepped away and take a phone call that had bothered me. And I tried to pretend like things were as normal as they could be until I could get away from that crowd.
Did this shock you to hear this?
Yes, sir.
Is that something you expected to hear about your friend, the defendant?
Not at all. I mean, I didn't expect that to be the purpose of Lee's phone call to me when I took it.
What happened next? Did you attempt to call the defendant?
I think I texted him. I may have tried to call him after I got where I wasn't in the middle of a crowd of people. I think I may have called or texted him or both. And he texted me back something to the effect of that he couldn't talk right then. That I think he said he was meeting with probate attorneys or something to that effect, and that he couldn't talk right then and he would call later, or we could talk later.
When Lee Cope called you, did he say anything about this check that's up on the screen?
He did.
What did he say?
He said that they had found a check in Alex's office from my firm that was made payable directly to him. I don't remember exactly how he described it, but he said, we found a check. We found out that Alex's stealing money from the clients and the firm, and we found a check from your office. And I need to know if you've got that $792,000 in your account. We're going to need to get that paid to us, and I need you not to say anything until Tuesday when we can issue a press release.
How long do you think after you got that call or those calls from Lee that you tried to reach out to your friend, the defendant?
It probably took me an hour, maybe two, to finish what we were doing and get to where I could, where I felt like I could reach out to him without being in the middle of other people.
And what was his response again?
Something to the effect of he couldn't talk right then, that he was, I think it was something to do with the fact of meeting with probate attorneys or something like that, and that he would talk to me later.
This is on September 3rd?
Friday, September the 3rd. The phone call from Lee was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon or so.
Did you talk to Alec later on that day?
That night, yes, sir.
And what was your conversation then?
I don't remember if he called me or I called him and was able to get him. And I said, Alec, I need to know what's going on. You know, Lee has called me about this, and I need to talk to you, and it needs to be face-to-face. I need to know what's going on. And he was noncommittal about meeting, said he had a number of things he had to deal with, and that he would try to meet with me the next day.
Okay.
So what happened? I was at home. My wife was there. You know, I mean, I was talking to him on the phone, but I wanted to talk to him face to face to find out what was going on.
How were you feeling?
Shocked, betrayed, mad. I mean, I don't know, numb. Just, I didn't.
What happened the next morning? Was that Saturday?
Saturday morning, September the 4th.
What year?
2021.
Did you try to get in touch with the defendant?
I did. I woke up early that morning, told my wife. I mean, I had, you know, told her that evening that there was a problem. I didn't get into a lot of detail with her, just told her there was a problem. And woke up the next morning, told her I was going to drive down to Buford. I thought Alec was staying at his brother's house, and I was going to drive down and talk to him. And so I got in the car and took off driving towards Okotie.
Trying to get in touch with him and
called him a bunch.
Not getting in touch with him?
No answer. No, sir.
So you just decided to go on down there and find him?
Yes, sir.
So you drive where?
I started driving down I-95 towards Okotie, and he called me before I was going to get off and go to John Marvin's place. But he got off. He called
me
before.
Slow down. You say Okotie. What's Okotie?
I mean, that's what I call the area where his brother John Marvin lives. It might not be technically correct, but that's what I call it.
But that's where you thought he was?
I was under the impression that's where he was staying, yes, sir.
So you were just going to show up?
I was hoping that he would call me back on my way, but if not, I was just going to show up, yes, sir.
And so what happened along the way?
He called me while I was on the road down there and told me that he was sorry he hadn't been able to take my calls and that he would meet me at his mother and father's house in Alameda.
Did that meeting ultimately happen?
It did.
About what time did that happen?
Kind of late mid-morning. I want to say around 11 o'clock or so, sometime before lunch.
Okay. And so tell me about that meeting.
I got there before he did. I think I waited in the car out, maybe out at the front of the driveway, and then when he pulled in, I followed him in. We got out, didn't say anything in the driveway. went through the side door. I believe the caretaker was there. The lady that helped take care of, one of the ladies at least that helped take care of Miss Libby was there. She went kind of towards the back and he and I went out on the front porch.
Okay. What was your conversation with him on the front porch? About what time was this again?
I don't know the exact time. Sometime between 10:30 and noon, but I want to say it was around 11 o'clock or so. Okay. It was about, I was there for about 20 minutes.
All right. Tell me about the conversation that you had.
We went out on the front porch. We still hadn't said anything to each other other than he said, let's go out on the front porch and talk. We went out on the front porch and I looked at him and I said, Alec, and I'm sure I said F or H or something. I said, what is going on? I need to know what's going on. Because I know about this thing that Lee's called me about, and I need to know if there's something else you've done that involves me that I don't know about, that's a problem for me. What is going on?
What does he say?
He didn't say anything. He broke down crying. Said, I can't talk. I can't right this second, Chris. He walked inside and grabbed a handful of paper towels and came back out on the porch and said, you know, I'm sorry. I've had a drug problem. I'm addicted to opioids. And I don't remember if he said 20 years or exactly how many years, but he said, I've been addicted to opioids for something like 20 years, I think is what he said. And, you know, I don't remember exactly how the conversation went. There were parts where it was, I mean, I don't want to say heated, like we were screaming and hollering at each other and it never came to blows, but there were parts where it was heated and parts where it was silent and parts where it was probably calmer. He said he had a drug addiction. And then he admitted he had been stealing money, you know.
From who?
From his law firm and from clients.
Did he say?
He didn't specifically spell any certain person out or any certain organization out, but he said, I've been stealing from the firm and from clients.
What did he say about that 192 with you? What was the phrase he used?
I mean, I have to cuss to say it. He said,
go ahead and say it.
He said, I shit you up. I'm sorry, I've shit you up. And shut a lot of people up. I asked him, how long has this been going on? Couldn't believe that I didn't know it. Never saw it. Never suspected it. Drugs or money.
And what did he say?
Just said it had been going on for a long time.
Did you say anything else in this conversation?
Just that he had been good about covering it up, especially the drugs. I mean, I didn't really ask much about I didn't know the extent of the client stuff. I knew about me and my $192,000. And in the phone call with Lee, he had said that Alec had been stealing from the firm and from clients. But I didn't know about any specific clients or any specific cases. So we didn't talk about that. I didn't ask about that.
How'd the conversation end?
I don't remember exactly how it ended. I know I left. I don't remember. Like I said, I know we didn't come to blows and we weren't screaming and hollering at each other when I left, and I wasn't screaming and hollering at him. I was angry. I didn't know how to feel. But at some point I left.
Where'd you go after that?
I started driving back to Columbia and just went through the drive-thru at Hardee's and Hampton to grab something for lunch on the way out.
Since that conversation on September 4th, shortly before noon, have you had any conversation with the defendant since then?
No verbal conversations. No, sir.
Did you ever get a text from him?
I've received one or two texts from him.
Show you what's been marked as States 351. See if you recognize this.
Yes, sir. It's a text I received from Alec on September the 16th. I responded on September the 17th.
but states 351 up on the screen. That's the text you received from Alec.
For that in evidence.
Not my apologies, Your Honor. This time I'll state 351 in evidence.
Yes, sir.
No additional objections.
Submitted.
All right. Now I'm going to put it up on the screen. Is that the text you received from the defendant?
It is, yes, sir.
Was that the usual number you have for him, or was that a different number?
It's not the normal number. I don't know that I'd ever seen that number before.
Since that time, you haven't had any conversation with him?
I think he texted me maybe one other time, and I tried to respond with something as basic as what I said there, just trying to respond, but not really communicate. I think there may have been one other text very similar to that.
You ever get that $192,000 back?
No, sir.
And when you covered your friend and put that in your trust account, is it because you trusted him?
Yes, sir.
On June 7th, 2021, you're looking again at States 452. The defendant texted you, call me if you up, correct?
Yes, sir.
And going back to 451, you called him once and he didn't answer, and then got that second call, is that correct?
Yes, sir. He texted me at 9:52. I called him at 9:52. 1 minute, there was no answer. And then I called back at 9:53.
All right. And that was a 3 minute call, that second call?
I can't read on the sheet, but it was very short. I think it was two or three minutes.
2 or 3 minutes? 3 or 4 minutes?
Yes, sir. Very short.
And you talked to him, I think you've testified, mentioned a couple things, and he said that he was where and he needed to go?
He said, I'm about to get back home. You know, service is always bad out here. Can we just talk tomorrow? Or he might have said, I'm about to get back to Moselle. I don't remember which phrase he used.
Any questions the defense has?
Mr. Griffin?
Good morning, Mr. Wilson.
Good morning, Mr. Griffin.
One thing you said in answering Mr. Waters' questions on when you got to Moselle late night on the 7th or early morning on the 8th, he asked you something about, did you talk to Alec about the fee issue? And your response was, I did not know there was an issue with the fee. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you did not know that there was any issue with the fee on June 7th, 2021, correct?
No, sir.
The only conversation you had with anyone about the fee on before June 7th, 2021 from the law firm was with Lee Cope, correct?
Yes, sir.
And he just asked you something about Do you still have money from the Ferris case in your trust account?
He asked me if all the money had been dispersed from those cases.
And you told him it had not. And you told him truthfully it had not, correct?
Yes, sir. We were holding money back from medical liens, cost, a number of different things.
And you never had any follow-up questions by Mr. Cope before June 7th, right?
No, sir.
You did have a conversation with Alec, and he gave you some explanation. I forgot. What was the explanation he gave you?
After my paralegal, Vicki, forwarded me that email that she had received from their firm saying that there was an issue with the cost, I called Alec and said, hey, look, I'm got this email that says there's a problem with cost that you think you're owed more cost, no mention of fees. And if you were owed more cost, just let me know what they are and we'll get it worked out. We were holding money to deal with some things, and I didn't think the client would have any problem making sure all our costs got paid before the final amount of money was dispersed to the client. I said, hey, if there's a problem with cost, let me know. And he said, no, it's good. I said, hey, this is the case I dispersed directly to you on the fees. Is everything all right? He said, yeah, it's fine. The firm knows about it. I just got to make sure they know it's on the books already.
So he wasn't panic. There was no panic in his voice about conversation about the fee you had?
Nothing that I heard or saw, right, sir.
So as far as you knew, as of June 7th, there's no issue with the fee, right?
I didn't know about any issue with fees prior to June the 7th or even after that.
And no one was demanding from you the Ferris fee money, the PMPED portion of the Ferris fee money?
No, sir.
Before June 7th?
Right? No, sir. I had not received any direct contact or request for payment of fees. My paralegal had already advised his paralegal that the fees had already been paid.
Okay. Now you said a number of times on your testimony that in June and July you were worried that Alec may kill himself.
We were worried that, I mean, he was distraught. He's destroyed and upset all the time, and not eating, not sleeping, sometimes not seeming like he was just focused in and even there. And not just me, I mean, his law partners, his family. I talked to his brothers, I talked to his partner several times throughout the month of June and July just about him and what we were worried about may happen or what he may do.
And the reason he was distraught was over the death of Maggie and Paul, right?
Yes. I mean,
and at no point in time when you're thinking, I'm afraid he might hurt himself, you weren't thinking he had any involvement in June, July, during this period of time with the murders of Maggie and Paul.
No, sir.
And that he was, your thoughts were with him because he was a grieving husband and father.
Yes, sir. My thoughts were with him, you know, his whole family and you know, especially him and Buster.
And you reached out to him as much as you could.
Yes, sir.
Now, there did come a time when you were a little worried about your $192,000 and you asked him to sign this handwritten promissory note.
Yes, sir.
You testified about that. And you had a conversation about how he's going to get you paid, right?
Yes, sir.
And in that conversation...
Well, that conversation about how he was going to get me paid, I think, was prior to that. I don't think we talked about how I was going to get paid when he signed the $192,000. I just simply knew enough to know, or felt like I knew enough of probate law and law, that if something happened to him, whether he did it to himself or something else happened to him, and I couldn't make a claim against his estate without that piece of paper. So I don't think we talked about payment or how he might get me paid that day. He had mentioned previously that he was trying to deal with Maggie's estate, he was trying to deal with his father's estate, and he had some property he thought was going to sell.
But he was telling you that he did not have the money at the time.
Yes, sir.
When you had, and that conversation was before the day of the promissory note, which I think is mid-August or something.
August 17th, I think it was.
and that he mentioned that Maggie's estate was tied up. His dad had died. You remember when his dad died?
Very vividly, yes, sir. Very much. I mean, it was Thursday, June the 10th.
June the 10th. It's like 3 days after Maggie and Paul were murdered, right?
Yes, sir.
And that wasn't unexpected, was it? His dad had been seriously ill.
No, sir. I went by to see Mr. Randolph one of those days after June the 7th, but before June the 10th, my wife and I had gone down to see Buster and Alec, or she had come down while I was already there, and we rode over to Alameda to see, actually see Randolph, but to see Libby too.
And I guess he died within a day or so of you visiting with him.
So I think it was the next day.
But Alec thought he was going to get some money from his dad's estate that maybe didn't go through probate that would enable him to quickly pay you back.
That's what he said. Yes, sir. I don't think he said anything about it going directly through. He just said, you know, I've got some money that'll be coming to me from my father's estate also.
And, you know, the difference between life insurance, beneficiaries of life insurance policy, the benefits do not go through the estate, do not get tied up in the estate.
Just enough to be dangerous, probably, but yes, sir.
Well, the point is, he never said to you, oh, I have this $1 million policy on Maggie's life, I have a $5 million policy on Maggie's life, or any life insurance that he was expecting to come into as a result of Maggie's death, right?
No, sir, not at all.
And after Maggie died and Paul died, he wasn't out spending lavishly with newfound money, was he?
No, sir, not that I saw.
In fact, you know, he didn't even go to Moselle to stay a single night after Maggie and Paul were murdered. You know that?
I don't know that myself directly, but every time I spoke to him, he was either staying with his brothers or staying with his in-laws. I don't think he ever went back to Moselle.
Now, you've known Alec for
1985, 86, however long that is.
That's
37 years, I guess, if my math's right.
Your math's better than mine.
38, something right. Like that.
And he said to you that he had an opioid addiction for over 20 years?
I don't remember exactly the number of years, but I mean, I believe it was, he said I've been addicted to opioids for about 20 years or more than 20 years.
Well, let's just say the last 5 years.
Yes, sir.
Over the last 5 years, you've known him. If he was addicted to opioids, did you notice any change in his behavior?
Not a thing, not at all.
And you were around him in a business capacity?
Yes, sir.
Professional? You were sending him cases?
Yes, sir.
He was acting like the normal Alec that you've known since college?
Since law school.
Since law school?
Yes, sir.
And nothing about his demeanor set red flags off to you as to, man, he must be on something today.
No, sir. I mean, I didn't see pill bottles when we would travel together for depositions or things like that. He didn't seem to be out of it. He seemed to be capable of handling the work that we were doing. You know, when we would socialize together, didn't see anything that indicated that he was addicted or had a drug problem or was using drugs.
And if he was addicted to drugs for the last 5 or 10 years, and he was, from your observation, was a loving husband and father?
Yes, sir.
And you didn't observe him engaging any erratic behavior around his wife and kids?
No, sir.
Do you know anything about the, from your medical, well, not your, from your legal career handling personal injury cases, do you know, have you learned information about building up tolerances to painkillers, patients and clients of yours who have built up tolerances?
Not really enough to talk about it much or testify for sure.
Sure. So I'm going to go back, cover some ground you've already talked about.
Sure.
law school, you and Alec were roommates at one point in time.
Right? We were, yes,
and,
sir.
And then he actually married Maggie while he was in law school, right?
He did.
And you married Dana after you graduated or while you were in law school as well?
Shortly after graduation.
And Maggie and Dana were sorority sisters at University of South Carolina?
They were.
You went to South Carolina Law School, but you were...
Wofford College in Spartanburg.
Harvard of the Upstate, right?
Yes, sir.
And you became really good friends with Alec during law school.
Alec and I got to be, we were friends and hung out a lot, studied together, did some things like that first year. But we got to be much closer friends throughout that end of the first year of law school. We lived together second year, and he married Maggie into our third year of law school.
And then you married Dana, and y'all would do a lot of things together as couples, wouldn't you not?
Yes, sir.
And one of the things y'all like to do is go to South Carolina football games. Right?
Yes, sir.
And, you know, Alec played for the University of South Carolina. You knew that.
Yes, sir.
And had a knee injury when he was playing?
I did know that, yes, sir.
And then as you grow as married couples, you had children, he has children. Your oldest daughter was 1 year younger than Buster?
Yes, sir.
And then you have a son who's
two years younger than
Paul, right?
Yes, sir.
And your daughter and Paul were really good friends.
Yes, sir.
And friends with Buster as well.
Yes, sir.
And
our kids grew up together.
Exactly.
Even our youngest, who's younger than their two, they all grew up together.
And you and Dana and your kids and Maggie and Alec and Paul and Buster would vacation together when they were younger before the kids started wanting to do things on their own, right?
Yes, sir. We would vacation together and go, you know, on trips away while the kids were younger and would follow you around. And as they got older, kind of doing their own things, those vacations kind of went by the wayside. But we would spend a lot of time down at Edisto Beach. We have a house down at Edisto, and they had a house at Edisto. And so a lot of our time together would be spent down there or at Columbia, Carolina football games or things like that.
Right.
I mean, my wife and Maggie were sorority sisters and became much closer friends through Alec and my friendship.
Now, I'll get on to that a little more. And you did a lot of work with Alec. You weren't in the same law firm with him, but you worked on same cases or related cases a lot, correct?
Yes, sir. More so in the beginning, but throughout the entire time I've known him, yes, sir.
And so just sort of some examples. So if two people were in an automobile accident, one's a driver and one's a passenger, the same lawyer shouldn't represent both parties to the accident, right?
In most cases, yes, sir.
And so frequently you would send him the passenger or the driver or vice versa.
Sometimes it would be that, and sometimes it would just be straight, I represent somebody who's been injured in some way, and I need you to help me with that one person. But sometimes what you're talking about there about referring the one of the two people out is called conflict of interest or conflicting them out.
Right.
And Alec would conflict me cases sometimes, and I would conflict him cases sometimes.
And you had a lot of respect for his ability as a lawyer, right?
I wouldn't have associated him or sent people to him if I didn't.
And you wouldn't have associated him on the Ferris case if you didn't think he could do a good job.
Right? Not at all.
And he did a really good job in the Ferris case, right?
Yes, sir. I mean, our result was very, our client was very satisfied with the result.
And Alec participated fully in the entire case. And I think Mr. Waters asked, he even gave the closing argument to the judge, right?
He did. I mean, we had to spend a lot of time getting ready for trial, even though it wasn't in front of a jury, which sometimes doesn't come with quite as much quite as many things to have to do. Even in front of a judge, it takes a lot of work to put a case together. And so we spent a lot of time getting ready for that trial and even working the weekend before it started in Columbia out of a central location there.
And had you tried cases with Alec in the past?
I have.
Tried cases with Alec in front of the juries like this right here?
Yes, sir.
And I don't have to tell you, but you know, doing what we're doing here, it can be very stressful, can it not?
It's very stressful, yes, sir.
Yeah. Long nights, and get up early in the morning.
A lot of hours juggling a lot of things.
And did you ever, were you around him during the stress of trial or cases where he just totally lost it, lost his faculties, just went off on the handle because he was on opioids? Did you ever see anything like that?
No, sir.
He was able to function in high stress situations, correct?
Yes, sir. I mean, sometimes getting out, like, a focus on the case and on what you were trying to get accomplished was difficult, but that was from all the way back in law school. That was from day one. But when he focused, he was extremely able to get it done.
And one witness described Alex Normal as being fidgety.
Just sometimes not as focused as you'd like for him to be. He was taking phone calls and talking to this and looking at that and taking another phone call. And, you know, sometimes you say, look, man, we got to sit down and focus on this and get this taken care of.
Now, that brings me to another point. Would he always take a phone call if Maggie called him?
Always.
Would he always take a phone call if Paul called him?
Always.
Would he always take a phone call if Buster called him?
Always.
No matter what was going on?
When I was around him, if we were in court, he wouldn't take a phone call, but in depositions, he would sometimes get up and walk out and take calls. And if you were talking to him, I mean, trying to get a full conversation out with him in one breath was impossible because he was going to take a phone call.
And you traveled around with him for business?
Yes, sir.
Was he frequently talking to his wife and sons?
Yes, sir. Seemed to be.
You talked to him multiple times a day, right?
Yes, sir.
When you were with him, did you see him talking to Maggie, Paul, or Buster multiple times?
I mean, I could tell who he was talking to on the phone. We didn't have to travel as much together later in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years just because we were working less cases. Sometimes we wouldn't have to go as many places for depositions and things. But yes, if we were traveling, I could tell he was talking to his family on the phone.
Right. Was it hard to get Alec to go on guy trips? Did he prefer to spend time with his family over guy trips?
He seemed to, yes, sir. I mean, most any trip that I think I've ever been on with Alec generally was family.
Right.
He's not the kind of guy that would take off and go spend a golfing weekend with us, or I think they like to spend their time hunting and fishing and doing things as a family.
And you, going back to this Ferris case that was tried in Columbia, do you remember Maggie coming up and staying with him during the trial?
I don't. I mean, I think she may have come up like that Sunday before we started the trial. I was staying at home in Columbia and he was staying in a hotel. So I think that's why I stayed in the hotel, because Maggie was coming. And we were in that point, I think we were just renting a house because we were between places and didn't have a lot of space. But I wouldn't want to testify to that under oath, but I think so.
Sure. You would go to lawyer conventions with Alec? I mean, you would go to the same conventions.
Sure.
And you mentioned the trial lawyers, one in Hilton Head, first weekend of every August.
Yes, sir.
And before the tragic events of June 7th, 2021, would he always go with Maggie and Paul and Buster?
Most all the lawyers that go to that convention bring their families along. It's a big time that everybody gets to know each other's family, and Maggie and Paul and Buster would always be there.
And during football season, South Carolina, did he and Maggie have season tickets?
Yes, sir.
He'd go to the games with his family?
Yes, sir.
And you would tailgate with them?
Yes, sir. They would generally have a family tailgate that Miss Libby would put together. And then when she got sick, I don't remember who kind of took it over, but they always had a family tailgate. And if we weren't tailgating with them, we would always make it a point to stop by and at least speak.
And he had, they had season basketball tickets.
Yes, sir.
Right. And he and Maggie would go to just about every home basketball game.
Yes, sir.
for the University of South Carolina men's basketball team.
Yes, sir.
We had some pretty bad basketball teams over the years. Right?
They were actually pretty good, I think, in those years. But
okay.
I think that was Final Four. Actually, I think Alec bought the tickets for the year after the Final Four when they tanked. So,
right.
Yeah, you might not have seen the best basketball.
And then you went to baseball games together.
Yes, sir.
And
I don't know how much baseball. We didn't do a lot of baseball ourselves, but I think they did some.
And we'll get to this, but the weekend before June 7th, it would be June 6th and June 5th, you actually went to the Super Regionals with Maggie and Alec and Buster and his girlfriend Brooklyn, you and your wife, correct?
Yes, sir. It was only on that Saturday that we were with them, which would be June the 5th. They had come up for the weekend Carolina baseball tournament, and my wife and two of our children met up with them on Saturday and went and hung out at some mutual friends' place for a while before we all went to the ball game, kind of separated and went to different seating areas at the ball game.
Would you agree that Alec's number one priority was his family?
Yes, sir, appeared that way to me.
When I say his family, I'm talking about Maggie, Paul, and Buster.
His whole family, yes, sir.
And you mentioned that you became good friends with Maggie's family, Mr. and Ms. Brandstetter.
Yes, sir.
And her sister Marion. And
not so much with Marion and her husband Bart. I mean, I knew them and I was around them, but not so much friendly or close to them as with Maggie's mom and daddy.
And what was Alec's relationship with Maggie's dad?
Seemed to have a very good relationship with them. Spent a lot of time together. They would come to Moselle, or Maggie and Alec and their children would go visit them in Somerville, or Papa T would come up sometimes and try to hunt or do things like that.
You knew him as Papa T as well?
Yes, sir.
And what did you know Miss Brandstetter as?
Miss Ken. I think they called her Grandma, but I called her Miss Ken.
And they vacationed at Edisto, Mr. and Ms. Brandstetter, with Alec and Maggie and Buster and Paul, right?
They would be at Edisto some, yes, sir.
And can you tell the jury a little bit about Alec's relationship with Paul and Buster's friends?
Alec and Maggie both seemed to welcome, I mean, they were great to my children and seemed to welcome my children into their house and into their lives. And did the same for Paul and Buster's other friends.
And the and at Edisto was Alec and Maggie's home, was that opened up to a lot of Paul and Buster's friends? They have a lot of people staying over, coming over and visiting?
You know, it seemed to be that way. I mean, I wasn't over there all the time when there were children or kids around, but sometimes, yes, sir, and my kids would say, especially my daughter would say, I'm going over to hang out with Paul and poor Buster at their place.
Right. And do you remember, sort of move forward, Memorial Day weekend of 2021?
I do.
Did you and your family go to Edisto that weekend?
We did.
And was Alec down there with Maggie and Paul and Buster and some of Paul's friends?
They were.
And do you remember getting together over at Alex, Maggie's home over that weekend?
Yeah, we got together Saturday evening, I believe it was. We got together to cook out over at their house Saturday evening with them and a bunch of other people.
And Maggie and Alex getting along as far as you knew?
Yes, sir.
Was it a fun time had by everyone, best you could tell?
Yes, sir. I think it was right around about Alec's birthday. We were doing. We not only were cooking out like a big shrimp bog, but also having some cake and kind of a little birthday celebration.
Right. I want to play that right quick, Your Honor. I think it's Defendant's Exhibit 61 or 59, Doug.
61
is in evidence, Your Honor. Play it very briefly. Tell me if this is what you're referring to.
Yes, sir.
Apparently we don't have audio again. Just run it through. We don't have to have audio. Who is that?
It's Paul.
That Alec?
Yes, sir.
And that's you?
Yes, sir.
Was that a typical family gathering? Was this something like really didn't happen very often?
No, that was, I mean, the times that I was around them and their family, things were much like that.
So that was the weekend of Memorial Day weekend. And then the very next weekend was the Super Regional Baseball Games in Columbia, right?
Yes, sir.
And that's when you you met up with Maggie and Alec on Saturday at a tailgate with, y'all had a mutual friend, I think maybe whose son played?
Son played for Carolina, yes, sir.
Right.
I think it was one of Maggie and Dana's sorority sisters and a guy that Alec knew from college, but I don't know if they were, I don't know how they knew each other, and their son played first base for Carolina.
Okay. And the
and it was Maggie, Alec, Buster, and his girlfriend, Brooke.
And you you stayed, you maybe you didn't see Alec and Maggie on Sunday, but I think y'all text, communicated, or, you know, just about how poorly
we talked, and my wife talked to Maggie. We Saturday after we tailgated before the game, we all split and went our separate ways to go sit in different areas. And I don't think we saw them after that on Saturday. We were supposed to get together on Sunday or try to get together on Sunday, but didn't do so and ended up going to the game separately. But we talked or texted, and I think Dana talked or texted with Maggie.
Sure. And I believe you testified earlier that during this weekend you had learned, gotten an update on Alec's dad, and he wasn't doing so well?
Yes, sir. I know on Sunday I talked to Alec when they were going home, or they were headed home, and we were talking about just how the Gamecocks had, you know, blown the chance to move forward, and we talked about his dad, and that's when he told me things were getting much worse with Mr. Randolph.
Okay.
But I kind of already knew that from the days and, you know, leading up to that. I already kind of knew that. We had talked about it before, but I remember that Sunday, him telling me things were really getting much worse.
And you knew that. It was a common knowledge in the tight-knit legal community of Hampton and Colleton area?
I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I knew that. And okay. People seem to know that, yes, sir.
And Mr. Randolph was a, yes, I mean, he was beloved by a lot of people, was he not?
Yes, sir.
And not just his immediate family, but the broader legal community.
And most people I knew that knew Randolph seemed to respect and love him.
Right.
Really, everybody I knew.
Right. And we know he died on June the 10th, right?
Thursday, June the 10th, yes, sir.
There's been, how's it been? You mentioned something. I just want to go back to the Ferris case and you and Alec and Mr. Ridgway, who were representing the plaintiffs, Ms. Ferris, or the estate, that you thought Mack Truck didn't want to produce some discovery, and that leveraged y'all an ability to basically just have a damages hearing.
Yes.
With a judge, is that right?
Yes, yeah, so we had some discovery we had asked for. They sought not to produce it. We had some motions to compel that were argued. I think we were successful in those. I mean, I can't say what they were thinking, but it felt like that we had an opportunity to structure a good chance for our client to get a good result, because they didn't want us moving forward with some discovery.
And so in the Ferris case, you succeeded in getting an order to produce the information you sought, yet y'all worked out a different way to resolve the case, is that right?
Just kind of, not to get too deep into it, but just give you some context. This is like, there was only one prior reported case of something like this happening in the world that we could find, like in Australia or something.
Right.
And this was one of the only times that it had happened while a vehicle was actually in motion on a highway. I think it might have been the first time that it actually happened. So there was very little, there was very little chance we felt like that we were going to be able to make a punitive damage case out of it, because there had not been a lot of prior instances for Mac to be on notice on. So for us to waive that didn't feel like we were giving up much. And I think they did not want us to discover some things, because there might be other cases that were coming from that defect. This was very early on in the discovery of that defect and right. and things starting to happen with it.
And then moving back on track, I'm sorry for diverting, but
sure.
On Monday, June the 10th, you didn't speak to Alec any during the day, as I understand it.
Monday would have been June 7th, but I don't remember.
I'm sorry, that's Monday, okay. June 7th, yes.
Yeah, I don't remember speaking to him on that day, earlier in the day.
But you had some things you needed to talk to him about. And you mentioned a case where, a potential products liability case.
Yes, sir.
And that whoever was holding the equipment wanted to, either you got to come inspect it or don't inspect it.
Yeah, they wanted us to go ahead and get it inspected, so that they could put it back in operation. We needed to gather what we wanted from it so they could repair it and put it back in operation.
And so Alec calling you on Monday, June the 7th was not surprising, right?
No, sir.
I mean, because you could talk multiple times a day, you just hadn't talked this day.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And and you would talk to him when he was traveling, you know, to the office and back to Moselle frequently. I mean, it wasn't the first time you'd ever talked to him when he left Moselle or coming back to Moselle.
I mean, I don't know where somebody is when I'm talking to him on the phone, but I mean, it oftentimes he would say, I'm, you know, headed to Moselle or I'm leaving the office. I mean, it felt like a lot of times when he do the same thing I do. You make your phone calls while you're in the car,
because right.
you're busy doing other stuff if you're at the office or wherever else.
But it was a little more than that. I mean, you knew that when he was coming up to Moselle, the phone would
phone
normally
service,
drop.
Phone service is bad out there, yes, sir.
And you'd drop a call, would you not?
Yes, sir.
And you've been out in Moselle a lot, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
And calls get dropped out there frequently, do they not?
Yes, sir.
And you can frankly be in one part of the house and maybe have coverage and be in another part of the house and not have coverage, right?
I don't really know about parts of the house, but I mean, there'd be times that I'd be on the phone that I would drop service or not be able to get on the internet or do things like
right.
that.
And
this spotty.
And just driving around the rural areas, I guess you know some areas where they're just dead spots and you just know there's going to be a dead spot coming up.
Very much so.
And there were such spots on Moselle Road, were they not?
For me, when I was trying to use my phone, yes, sir.
Okay. Now you went over your phone bill to get times for phone calls and you went through them, but I want to go through some more detailed documents that are in evidence,
sure.
reviewing your phone calls with Alec on the 7th and Defendant's Exhibit 60 is in evidence. And Doug, if you'll go to page 3078. And let me give you your copy of your Verizon bill. I guess Verizon, was that the service provider?
Yes, sir.
451, it's in evidence. I'm gonna hand it to you and just compare along to some of this detailed information. And Doug, if you'll go down to the bottom entry, 9/12/14. You got that pulled up? Can you see this and compare it to your phone bill? But it says Alec Murdoch calls Chris Wilson at 9:12:14, and it was a 42-second call. Does that sound about right? I don't know that your Verizon bill is accurate this, on the time.
Is this supposed to be June the 7th, Monday, June the 7th?
Yes, sir.
My phone bill that I pulled and provided, or my phone records that I pulled and provided this led, say I had an incoming phone call from phone number ending 1227, which is Alex's cell phone number, at 9:11 p.m. that lasted 2 minutes.
Okay. And so some of these extraction data that's in evidence says the call is 42 seconds long. Do you think you talked to him for 2 minutes, or you may have been billed for 2 minutes, but when you got the call, you said, I'm fixing the pump, can I call you back?
Yeah.
Is that a 2 minute call, or is that a 45 second call?
Hey, Bo, how you doing? I'm doing all right. I got my hands in the middle of this. Can I call you back? Yeah, sure, no problem. I mean, probably shorter than 2 minutes. I don't know if that's the phone ringing and the talking.
Right.
I don't know how that works.
Okay. And then, but that was the call. And there was nothing about Alex's demeanor that alarmed you during that conversation, right?
No, sir.
He wasn't breathing heavy, was he?
No, sir.
He didn't sound panicky in any way, did he?
Not panicky, no, sir.
Just a regular conversation with Alex?
All conversations with Alec are a little bit scattered, but no, he didn't sound out of the ordinary.
All right. And then you call him back.
I did.
Sometime around 9:20. What's your Verizon bill say?
9:20 p.m. A phone call from me that lasted 3 minutes.
All right. And if you'll go to page 3082 of Exhibit 60, and if you'll, Doug, pull up the call at 9:20 with Mr. Wilson. You see it? Now, I mean, it really doesn't matter whether the Verizon bill says 2 to 3 minutes, this says 131 seconds, but this is you calling Alec back, correct?
Yes, sir.
And in that call, he is he's got the same demeanor?
Yes, sir.
Not breathing heavy?
No, sir.
Not being frantic in any way?
No, sir. Just not that I heard.
Normal Alec?
Yes, sir.
And he tells you he just gets to his mom's, and that's how you end the call, right?
He says he's either getting to his mom or about to get to his mom's. I think he said, I'm about to get to my mom's. Let me call you when I'm leaving here.
All right.
Mr. Griffin, I thought he was leaving the office for whatever reason. I don't have any reason to know that. He didn't say that. But I just assumed he had kind of worked late at the office and was headed.
Sure.
Headed to check on his mom before he went home.
Okay.
But he said, I'm about to get to my mom's. He didn't even say, where he had been earlier or anything like that. Just, I'm about to get to my mom's. Well, can I call you? Can I call you later?
Would it strike you as odd that he'd be going to visit his mom at 9:20 in the evening?
No, sir. I know he visited his mom often. I thought it was mostly during the day, like he'd swing over there for lunch, check on his mom and dad, but it didn't strike me as out of the ordinary for him to go in the evening. I knew sometimes he would go later.
And were you aware that his dad had been put back in the hospital on that day?
Yes, sir. Or I knew he was, I don't know that I knew for sure he was. I know on that Sunday, Alec told me he was either, his daddy had was being taken to the hospital or was taken to the hospital that day.
And from your knowledge, how frequently would Alec go by and visit his mom and dad?
Almost every day.
Almost every day?
Yes, sir.
When he was in town?
Yes, sir.
And did Alec work odd hours, late hours?
He would usually be somebody that was working later in the evening than a lot of other people would be. Yes, sir.
So
I don't think he got started as early as everybody else does.
So I guess from what you're testifying, his demeanor would have been in his communications with you on this phone call at 9:20, same as if would have been any day he leaves the office. Yes. Nothing out of the ordinary.
Nothing struck me as out of the ordinary, no, sir.
And you think in this call you brought up that you needed to talk to him about the equipment?
I know I did that because they were starting to get frustrated with us and said this thing needs to get inspected so we can put it back in service. So we were needing to get that scheduled.
And he cut the call short before you finished your conversation about the equipment, saying he was had pulled up to his mom or about to get to his mom. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And then the next entry, which I'm not sure you, it wouldn't show up on your Verizon bill, but if you'll go to page 3086, Doug, at text at 952.15, which I believe that's in.
Mr. Griffin, I don't think we talked about the equipment deal when he told me he was pulling up to his mom's house.
Okay.
I mean, I asked about how his mom was doing and I asked about how his dad was doing. And I said, hey, I need to talk to you. I might have said, hey, I need to talk to you about this equipment case and I got something else I need to talk to you about work. We didn't get into any details about it. Okay. Because he said, I'm about to pull up to mom's, or I'm pulling up to mom's, let me call you back when I finish there.
Okay. Well, one thing we know you didn't talk about is the Ferris fee.
Right? Yes, sir.
Because there was no issue, as far as you knew, about the Ferris fee.
I knew of no issue with that, no, sir.
Okay. So, according to this exhibit that's in evidence, there's a text at 5:52, 15 seconds, says, call me if you're up, and I think you put that text into evidence. I may have it. And this states exhibit 4452.
Yes, sir.
Is that the text?
Yes, sir.
And what time did your well, I guess you printed that off your phone, is that right?
This exhibit 451 only shows my phone calls. It doesn't show text.
Well, the picture of the text message has a time on it, right?
Yeah, June 7th, 9:52 p.m.
Okay, and the extraction record says 9:52, 15 seconds, but you received that text?
I did.
Okay, and then if you'll go to right below that, there's a phone call that you made. You made to Alex at 9:52:59. On your Verizon bill, you see 9:52 phone call to Alex?
Yes, sir.
Now, earlier you testified that was a missed call, and you didn't talk to him. I mean, the extraction record says it was for 42 seconds. Do you think you called him, got him, and the call dropped, or do you think it's a missed call?
I don't remember talking to him on that call. I either got his voice message or it didn't answer at all. That's why I called back 1 minute later.
Okay.
He may have picked up, but I didn't speak to him and I didn't leave a message.
Okay. Well then the next call on the log, Doug, is 9:53:55 and what time's your Verizon bill say that you made that next call?
9:53 p.m.
Okay. And so right after you tried, according to this exhibit, it was like 42 seconds after you tried the first call.
Yes, sir.
You tried him back.
Yes, sir.
And when you got him, is that when you talked about the equipment inspection?
That's when I would have said, how's your mama doing? You know, how's your dad? We need to talk about this piece of equipment. We got to deal with this inspection that's upcoming. And I got some motions that I think it's some motions that I need some help with, something that I need a little guidance on to bounce off of you. So he was about to get back to Moselle or about to get back home and, you know, may lose service or was about to get back home and could we talk tomorrow?
I mean, did he in fact tell you I'm about to drop service?
I don't think he said I'm about to drop service. I think he said I'm about to get back to Moselle. You know, I may lose service. Can we talk tomorrow?
And again, demeanor is perfectly normal. And this last conversation you had with him at 9:53, correct?
Nothing stood out as different to me.
And he wasn't breathing heavy, wasn't being frantic. Nothing out of the ordinary, correct?
Yes, nothing that I heard was out of the ordinary, no, sir.
Okay. And then you went to bed and you got notified by your wife and the phone was blowing up and you immediately got in the car and went to Moselle, is that right?
Immediately, yes, sir.
And you got there roughly about 1 in the morning, is that right?
About 1 in the morning, yes, sir.
And you were directed to the main house?
Yes, sir.
And there you think Alex was already in the main house?
I know he was already there because I walked in. The first thing I did was walked over. He was crying and I was crying. I just walked over and hugged his neck. We didn't say a word.
You remember what he was wearing?
I don't.
Who was in the...
I think I remember a white shirt, but I don't remember for sure.
Well, when you were there, did SLED agents come and take his clothes?
I was not there that I remember seeing SLED agents take his clothes or anything like that. If they did, I was somewhere else in the house.
Okay.
I did not see any of that take place. I was told that they did, but I did not see that.
Well, you were told that when you were in the house?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did it appear that they had already taken his clothes when you saw Alec?
I have no idea.
Okay. Well, did you see him change clothes during the period of time you were with him?
Not while I was there, no, sir.
So while you were there, he had the same clothes on from when you got there to when you left?
As far as I remember, yes, sir. I mean, as far as I remember, yes, I was focused on my friend, son. I wasn't paying attention to whether he changed clothes or anything like that, but I don't remember him changing clothes or anybody taking his clothes, but okay. I wasn't really focused on that.
And what was Alec's demeanor that night?
He was destroyed.
He was destroyed?
Yes, sir. He was crying, quiet, just whimpering. Trying to be gracious to the people that had come at times, but I mean, none of us knew what to say. None of us knew what to do. There was a lot of quiet.
I want to ask you about the comment he was trying to be gracious. Is when Alec meets people coming up, is he polite, respectful? Is that his normal habit?
Yes, sir. He's good with people.
Okay.
I mean, he does it. He's the kind of person that I doesn't ever seem to have met a stranger. Always seems to talk to people.
Right. One of the things that let's set the table. You were there. And a number of his law partners were there, is that right?
As I recall, yes, sir.
You remember Mark Ball being there?
I don't remember Mark. I remember Mark being there at points and times, but I'm not sure about that night when I walked in.
Ronnie Crosby?
I remember Ronnie being there. Austin Crosby, Lee Cope.
Austin Lee, Randy?
Randy, yes, sir.
I guess his brother, John Marvin.
John Marvin was already there.
Okay.
I don't remember if Buster had already gotten there or not. I think he got there right after I got there.
And then y'all were there for a number of hours, and everyone said, you know, we just need to go and try to get some rest. And so you went to your office and laid down on the couch and tried to sleep, right?
Yes, sir.
And you were back at 9 in the morning?
Somewhere thereabouts, 9, shortly after.
And were the same lawyers there?
Pretty much. I mean, there was a lot of comings and goings, and, you know, at varying points in times, Alec's partners would some be there and some not. But, yes, sir, pretty much the same number of people and the same people the next morning.
Right. And at some point in time, there was a discussion and a recommendation that you agreed with, that Alec not speak to any law enforcement without somebody with him, right?
Well, we were standing around in the driveway talking, and I think it was Lee Cope, Mark Ball. I don't remember if Ronnie Crosby was in that conversation, a couple other people. And there was some discussion about Alec's interaction with SLED. And the discussion that was had was, look, he probably doesn't need to interact with SLED without by himself, because don't know what state of mind he's in and don't know what the circumstances are. But he also doesn't need 7 or 8 lawyers trying to advise him or deal with him. I made it very clear that I wanted to be his friend and not his lawyer, that I didn't feel comfortable with that, and that one person needed to be, for lack of a better term, the point person.
And the concern was that he wasn't in a state of mind to do so, to have conversations with law enforcement.
Well, I mean, Mr. Griffin, I mean, we're all lawyers, and even if you don't practice criminal law at all, even if all you do is civil law, every lawyer knows that generally criminal lawyers advise their clients not to interact with law enforcement without their involvement or at least their approval.
Go ahead.
And so every one of the lawyers standing there either knew that or should have known that.
But
so whether it was his state of mind or whether it's general, just the general, what we're all taught and trained, but yeah, we all felt like that Alec wasn't in a position where he needed to or maybe was even able to talk to SLED by himself.
And that's,
I felt that way, and everybody else expressed the same thing.
And then that gets to my point. You didn't believe he was able to talk to SLED because he was so distraught and destroyed over the murder of his wife and son.
That wasn't a decision. I mean, I'm not trying to argue with you. That wasn't a decision for me to make. That's why I did not want to be acting as his attorney. I wanted to be his friend. That's what I was there for. That would be a decision for whoever was going to be representing for him and his representation. Whoever it was going to be at that point in time, whoever was chosen as the point person, that was a decision for them to make about how he would interact with SLED.
Well, I understand. But you agreed with the recommendation that he was in a state of mind to sit down and talk to SLED by himself.
I agreed that he did not need to interact with SLED by himself. Yes, sir.
Based on his state of mind?
I can't tell. He was destroyed. He was upset. And I don't know whether he was able to talk with SLED at that point in time by himself or not, but I knew that that's not something that somebody should do.
Well, do you remember testifying for the state?
I've done criminal work in my past, way back in the past, and that's the advice that I would give every one of my clients.
Do you remember testifying before the state grand jury, stating he, Alec, wasn't in the state of mind to do so and that we all didn't need to be his lawyer?
I don't remember specifically saying that.
Well, I'll show you page 152, lines 22 through 25.
Sure.
See if it refreshes your recollection.
Sure. He was not in a good state of mind, I will tell you that.
152 down at the bottom.
You want me to read it out loud or just read it to myself?
I mean, does it refresh your recollection that that was your testimony?
Yes, sir. I said he wasn't in the state of mind to do so and that we all didn't need to be his lawyer. I didn't want to be his lawyer. I was his friend. Right. I didn't want to be in the lawyer scenario.
I understand.
He wasn't in a good state of mind, that's for sure, correct?
No, sir. Nobody was.
Right. Now, you got there about 1 in the morning, and there were a lot of people around Alec at that point in time?
There were already people inside the house around him, yes, sir.
And then when you left, Alec was with Randy, John Marvin, Buster by that time?
I think the decision was made they would go to that at least Buster and Alec would go to Alameda and spend the night. And I don't remember whether John Marvin or Randy went with them, but they were leaving as a family.
And as far as you know, that they left as a family? And they came back as a family the next day?
Yes, sir.
And when you got there the next day, there more people showed up around Alec.
Yes,
correct?
Sir.
And I think the Branstetters showed up eventually.
I don't remember. Yeah, I think Papa T and Miss Kim were there the next day.
Now, the immediate days following Maggie and Paul's murder, Alec spent a lot of time down in Somerville. Do you recall that?
Yes, sir.
And that's where Papa T and
where Maggie's parents lived.
Miss Kennedy, and spent a lot of time with them.
Same too, yes, sir.
And then he would stay with John Marvin down at Okotee. You mentioned
That's where I thought he was staying a lot. Yes, sir.
And he would stay with his brother Randy.
Yes, sir.
And then they would go to Edisto, he and Buster, sometimes.
There were several times that he and Buster would go to Edisto, and I'd try to go down and just see them there. I think they were just, I mean, I know Buster, and I think they were just trying to kind of go somewhere where there weren't quite as many people around.
And you begged him, I think you said, or encouraged him to come to the trial lawyers convention at Hilton Head so that maybe, you know, he and Buster could have some normal time.
At least to play golf with us one day. I told him he at least should do that.
And you were concerned he had lost a lot of weight, had he not? Or
he didn't seem to be sleeping or eating very well.
And he was... And as his friend, you tried to give him a shoulder to lean on and an ear to talk to, right?
Yes, sir.
And he asked you rhetorically, what are we going to do without Maggie and Paul? You remember that?
I don't remember those exact words, but I mean, he said he didn't know what he was going to do without them. Yes, sir. I don't know if he said, what are we going to do?
And he told you that he just couldn't go back to Moselle, that he was going to have to sell it because he just can't go back out there. Do you remember
he
that?
He talked to me about he and Buster were going to talk about selling Moselle. He didn't. I mean, that was Paul's thing. Paul loved that property and being on that property. And I don't know that Buster loved it as much. He did, but I don't know that he loved it as much as Paul. And I don't know that they, you know, that Ellie just talked to me about he didn't know that he was going to want to keep it. And that he didn't go back. I don't think he ever went back out there and spent another night. Don't know that for sure, but I never talked to him when he was there.
And you advised him just take it one day at a time?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Wilson, do you see Buster in the courtroom?
Stand up, Buster.
I do.
Is that Buster?
Yes, sir.
And is Brooklyn seated next to him? Can you stand up, Brooklyn? Is that Brooklyn?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. That's all the questions I have.
Thank you, Your Honor, briefly. You were asked by Mr. Griffin on June 7th whether or not you brought up anything about the Ferris fees, but at that point in time, you hadn't had to cover $192,000 for the defendant, had you?
No, sir, I had not.
And
July the 15th, 16th, 17th, somewhere around in that range, middle of July, that I had to cover that $192,000.
That he called you with some story about how he had the money in the wrong structures and he needed to send it back to you, but he was $192,000 short.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
I don't lead the witness.
Did the defendant tell you that the issue of notifying his firm had been handled?
Yes, sir.
About the fees?
Before I wrote the checks in March and afterwards.
Before June the 7th, you were asked about that call with Lee Cope.
Yes, sir.
And did you talk about some fees and expenses that were still pending?
Not with Lee Cope, no, sir.
What did you talk about with Lee Cope?
Lee asked me if all the money in the case, the Mack Trucks case, had been dispersed. And I told him that it hadn't. We were holding back some lien money, some medical bill money. And I was in Hampton, I believe, trying a case down there the whole week. And he approached me while I was working in and out of their office sometime. And I think that's when he approached me and spoke to me about it. And I told him I'd have to check. I wasn't in the office.
Did you tell Lee Cope at that time that you had already dispersed the fees and written them directly to Richard Alexander Murdoch?
No, sir. He didn't ask me about the fees.
You were asked about the phone call that took place, or the phone calls, series of phone calls that you had with the defendant on the night of the murders, correct?
Yes, sir.
And he called you first, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then he sent you a text saying you up?
Yes, sir.
But in those phone calls, you were the one who raised the issue about the equipment issue, correct?
Yes, sir.
Were you the one who raised the issue about the equipment?
I did. I mean, I kept up with our deadlines and things that needed to be dealt with. And I want to say that the lawyer had reached out to me sometime around that time. I don't know whether they couldn't get Alec or just chose me to be the person to reach out to, but I was being contacted.
You're asked about him going to visit his mother in Almeda, typically during the day. And were you aware that he didn't go visit his father that day, despite the news that he had been put in the hospital?
I don't know. I don't think we talked about that night on those phone calls, whether he had gone to see his father or not. I asked how his father was, but I don't think he told me whether he had gone to see his father or not.
You were asked about your conversations that night with him, and I think you said he was acting like the normal Alex.
Yes, sir.
And you were asked about the fact of your observations of him as a husband?
Yes, sir.
As a father?
Yes, sir.
You said you saw no erratic behavior over the years that you've known him?
No, sir.
Saw no evidence of opioid use over the years that you've known him?
No, sir.
You said that he came from a prominent law firm?
Yes, sir.
Prominent family?
Yes, sir.
That you respected him as a lawyer?
Yes, sir.
That his clients trusted him?
Yes, sir.
Leading. Object.
Sustained.
Was the defendant effective in closing argument?
Yes, sir, very.
Did the defendant show emotion in closing argument?
I mean, yes, sir, he did.
Was the defendant good with people?
Very good with people. That's one of Alec's strengths, is with clients and people he met, connecting to people that he, you know, didn't know quite as personally. He could make connections with people. He seemed to know what made people tick. He knew what was important to people. He could spot issues and address issues in a case. When you got him to focus, he could handle those things.
Did your kids grow up together?
They did.
Did you try cases with him?
We did.
You've done business with him over the years? Have you done business with him over the years?
Yes, sir, lots.
Have you been roommates with him?
Yes, sir.
When you covered $192,000 for him, did you trust him and believe him when what he was telling you?
I believe that he would pay me back and that what he had told me happened had happened.
On September 4th...
And I knew I had to cover that money. It was my trust account. So, yes, sir.
On September 4th, 2021, did he confess to you the truth of his life that those of whom were close to him, no one knew?
He confessed to me things about him that I didn't know.
And you had no idea about any of that?
No, sir.
And he said it had been going on for years, the reality of his life.
He told me that he had been addicted to opioids, and I think he said either 420 or over 20 years.
And also?
And that he had been stealing money from his clients in the firm.
And that was a lightning bolt because you had no idea, despite being his best friend.
Objection leading, argument.
Were you one of his best friends?
Yes, sir.
Did you have any idea about any of that had been going on for a decade?
I had been told by Lee Cope the day before in that phone call that Alec had been stealing from his firm and from clients and that he had a drug problem and was going into rehab, and that's the first I would have ever known that.
September 4th, 2021.
That was Friday, September the 3rd when I talked to Lee Cope. And then again when I talked to Alec on Saturday, September the 4th.
Hit you out of the blue.
Like a ton of bricks. I mean, it floored me when Lee called me. And I never expected that.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Further questions?
You may step down.
Thank you, Your
Honor. We'll recess now for 1 hour and 15 minutes. Please go to the jury room. Please do not discuss the case.
That wraps up segment two of continuing coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. There's much more to come here on the 9th of February, 2023. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.